The battle for Pokrovsk rages on. The Russians continue to advance. The Ukraine side continues to lose ground and, more importantly, lose men. Also, and this is not getting enough attention today, and while we're going to do a little bit of a deep dive, aside from the normal deep dive we do, specifically on the conduct of the war, because we are seeing a transition and an advancement or an evolution in the nature of the way these wars are fought. I keep talking to you a lot about this is an attritional war, and it's about how many men each side can bring into it. It's about how much defense industrial base capacity, et cetera. None of that has changed. But what has added to the Russian side is continued evolution on top of their numerical superiority and their defense industrial base superiority. And it is starting to have a real impact on the battlefield. We're going to start it off first today at their strategic view, and we're just going to kind of lay the foundation again with some of the newest information we have from Volodymyr Zelensky, who went to Kherson today and tried to relive a blast from the past. You may recall we've mentioned a few times about 3 years ago today, the Ukraine side forced Russia to abandon the city of Kherson. They had down in the southern part of the front, it was the biggest city that the Russians had taken in the first period of time, I think the first 6 months of the war. And then as things continued to progress on in 2022, by blowing up or at least damaging the Antonovsky Bridge over the Dnipro River, caused Russia some difficulties being able to support it. And their command had to come to a decision, do they want to try to defend the city and take the casualties when it was going to be hard to reinforce, or should they completely abandon it, save all of their troops, and just live to fight another day? As we know, that was the General Sorovikin's decision. He said, we're just going to abandon the city and we're going to move out. Then they blew the four bridges, etc. Now, of course, on the Ukraine side, it was a huge victory because their military forces and their issues of blowing those bridges or damaging them with, I believe it was HIMARS missiles at the time, did make it an untenable situation. So they deserve credit for what they did. And Zelensky went down there after the fact and really, hopped it up and talked about how great it was, et cetera, like you would expect after a signature victory. Well, today he went back to relive that day, and here's how it went.
Міста від росіян, окупанти втекли звідси. Ми пам'ятаємо, як сміливість наших людей зробила це, як українські прапори повернулись у місто.
Вітаю особисто вас. Ви зберегли цілісність України. Дотиснути ворога Херсон Україною. Бо це просто факт, сильний факт, що Росії тут не місце. Факт, що лише час відділяє нас від справжнього миру для України, від справжнього миру для Херсону, для всієї нашої землі.
Yeah, that's a nice moment. But listen, it's you really shouldn't go back to relive moments and celebrate something when the Russians are literally on the outskirts of taking another major city from you. So it's a little bit of a hollow victory. And frankly, even on those the faces of the troops there at the end, you saw them repeating glory to Ukraine, but you didn't see a lot of enthusiasm or emotion in there. Certainly not the way they did in the beginning when this thing was actually taken. There was a lot of enthusiasm because it was a significant success on the tactical front for the Ukraine side. No question about it. But the advantages that they gained there have been lost. The victory should have been a case because that was paired with the drive to compel Russia to abandon huge sections of the northern part of the front in the Kharkiv region. Thousands of square kilometers were eventually ceded by the Russians. Similar cases, in a lot of cases, the Russians were driven out because the Ukraine side was able to muster its forces without Russia being aware of it. But once they discovered the scale of the situation, it became a decision by the Russian command that there's no point in trying to fight for every square inch. They didn't have enough troops to do that anyway. So they again went back to basically the old school river, and then they set up new defensive lines there, which roughly held for the duration of the war. because of those two wins, Ukraine was in a great position, which, of course, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, Mark Milley, strongly encouraged them to make a deal then from a position of strength, et cetera. We know they didn't do it, and we have where we have now. So now that instead of taking that and leveraging it into something that could have been really useful and beneficial to Kyiv, they squandered it. And unfortunately, that mentality hasn't left. And you saw at the end of that, Zelensky was saying, just like we got cleared Kherson City, we're going to do the same thing to the rest of Ukraine. It's only a matter of time. That falls on deaf ears when the very men in the room can see that you are losing everywhere on the front. Not only is it not a matter of time until you regain everything, the men fighting see that they're losing everything. And if anything about matter of time, it's going to be before you lose the rest of the country. Now, later that same day, Volodymyr Zelensky released yet another video where this time he's talking about how there has been no progress for the Russian side in the city of Pokrovsk.
It is extremely important that the occupier has achieved no significant results. The Pokrovskaya sector, the areas of Dobropilia, and the Donetsk region in general, we are defending our positions. We are holding the line in all other sectors of the front as well, and this is the most significant result for our state. There was a report from Minister of Defense Denis Shmyhal. By the end of the year, in terms of weapons supply and defense production, we must fulfill all the tasks set for supporting the front, financing our army, and carrying out our deep strikes. Ukraine is currently applying its long-range sanctions against Russia virtually on a daily basis. And we have clear results in the form of reduced Russian capabilities every day. Russia must keep losing, and this is actually a peacemaking tactic.
Russia must keep losing. And this is actually a peacemaking process here. And he says, hey, we've been firing long-range drones of our own deep into Russia, hitting their oil infrastructure, their energy infrastructure. We have these sanctions on Russia, which is causing lots of trouble. Now, there is some truth to that. They do have new sanctions, a 19th package on top of what President Trump gave them a few weeks back with pretty major sanctions on their two of their biggest oil companies, which has caused difficulties for Russia. And they have been launching long-range drones. They hit some targets on the Russian energy infrastructure just about 48 hours ago. And they've been trying to do that on and off throughout this whole year. And they've been having some success. The question is, though, are the sanctions having a crippling effect? Are they actually bringing Russia to its knees? Are they forcing the leadership in the Kremlin to have to modify their military objectives? Or is it having no effect in there? Are these long-range strikes also having a direct impact at the front of the line? Of course, the answer to both of those is self-evident, is no. They're unpleasant for Russia. They're painful when they strike and where they strike. They're annoying, but they clearly have no impact whatsoever on the entirety of the front line. And that is the issue here. And when you see the president of your country bragging about something that you did in the first year of the war, they don't even have anything else after that. There have been no other signature victories to name. He certainly can't go to the 2023, the very near year after that, and say anything about offensive. The only thing you have is the Bradley graveyard, it was so called, with the very beginning of that offensive, where they just got a lot of vehicles blown up together and across the front there, and where they were trying to get to the Azov Sea. It was a complete disaster. Everything failed. They didn't even fully penetrate the first of five Russian defensive lines. They never even tested the rest of them, never got through it. So we can't go back to that. And then in 2024, I mean, since that time, they lost Bakhmut, they lost Avdiivka, they lost Mariupol, they lost Lysychansk, Severodonetsk. They tried to move into the Russian territory in Kursk. They lost 70,000 men in that process. That evaporated, and now then there's actually the Russians restated deeper inside the Sumy territory. They tried in the Krinky along the Dnipro River, lost thousands of men in a completely futile operations. They lost that as well. So everywhere else that he wants to look, he can't go back anywhere. So he's got to go 3 years into the past to get evidence of the only tactical success that they've had. And that by yourself should tell you something. And then Who knows what the actual number is, but it's probably somewhere close to 1 million killed in action. Some put the number at much higher. I don't have any way to independently know. I can just say it's got to be profoundly high based on the number of troops they keep mobilizing and they keep losing on the front. You have their commanders say that they are not able to recruit enough to offset the losses. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out that that math is working against the Ukraine side. So that's at the strategic level. Now, I want to go in today to look at what's actually happening along the entire front line, because it's not just Pokrovsk. For obvious reasons, everybody's really focused on that and a little bit on Kupiansk. But as we're going to see here, there's a lot more going on than that. And things are picking up speed across the entire front. And I'm also going to explain to you why. We're going to start off in the Zaporizhia area, because the Russians had been moving up along this line here, just along the outside here, where in this along the water here, you can see that there used to be a big lake here. A lot of that has been drained because of the loss of a dam that they had. But the Russians have continued to been pushing up, and now then here in just recent weeks, they've been pushing up even further. They've been pushing up into these now the gray zones around here. So they've been causing Ukraine to have to man these areas. They can't withdraw their troops from here because Pavlivka is one of the apparently the objectives of this, and they're continuing to go up the corn here, this along the edge of this water obstacle, which of course is pointing toward the Zaporizhia, the city. So Ukraine can't withdraw its forces from here because they have a large city that's in the crosshairs should Russians continue to move up that front. Then we move a little bit further up. Let me see where I went to next year. I think so you may recall Malatakhmatchka and Orkhiv. That was part of the 2023 offensive. And now then all that pretty much has been lost. And now it's in danger of losing even more. Moving up here, the next big area where Russia just in the last 24 hours and Kulyapolia. This area right here, this is something that's been the Russians have been having a lot of issues trying to take for a long time, haven't made a lot of progress until recently. And you see these bright red areas here. That's something that Russia is just in the last 12 hours has now gained full control over, this gray area, as they've been pushing this forward. And this one is in the last 12 hours also. It is not yet fully in Russian control, but Drivnopolia, they moved all the way from that point. So it's a pretty big move in a single day, getting closer and closer to the town of Kulyapolia in the south. We move up a little bit further. And of course, now we come to Novopavlivka, where another town that had been kind of in a semi-cauldron. You may recall, this is the area where the Ukraine side had a counterattack earlier this summer, took a lot of this territory back, lost it all. And now then you see, even in the last days, they're now moving up just right up to the edge and the outskirts of Novopavlivka. Then we come up to the infamous Pokrovsk. And we see in this area here, I'm gonna show you something here in a minute. There is some battle scene footage that was seen today earlier that was released on a number of different platforms in fog. If you have seen it, I'm going to give you some, I'm going to show it to you here in a little bit, but there are some really important things from this. It's not just a scene from it, but this shows you, first of all, where it is. It's from this area right here. It's already in Russian control, and they're continuing to move forward. So what little parts of Ukraine, of Pokrovsk that the Ukraine side still has under its control are becoming more and more untenable, and there's virtually nothing. They say it's 95%, but in effect, you don't. I think this one spot right here, and maybe a little bit of this area down here, are the only things that Ukraine still has fully control of in the city of Pokrovsk. Everything else has been lost or is in the gray zone, which is effectively the end of it. So, for all intent and purposes, Pokrovsk is lost. It'll probably be a matter of 2 or 3 days before the city is fully announced as having fallen. We'll certainly cover that when it happens. What that has left, though, is the sister city of Mirnograd and this field down here. You see that's continuing to move forward as well. Russia has moved more and more into the actual city, into the city streets of Mirnograd. This is now in the gray zone here. And then down in the south, this portion of Mirnograd is more and more deeply into the red. And in the southern part, Russia's moving forward here too. Everywhere you want to look, the Ukraine side is covered in pressure from the Russians, and they're moving in literally on all sides. Also from the eastern side here, you see the Russians are now moving from Pokrovsk now also to try possibly to cut off a new band, and they may try to cut this in half. You see this penetration they've made here, and if they continue to push forward in this area here, it wouldn't take much to cut this off, and then even this will be cut into two separate areas where they cannot mutually reinforce each other, making it even more likely that this entire area falls. The one area where the Ukraine side does still try to push forward is in the Rodinska area, and they are doing everything they can to try and break this penetration off. What is unclear is the Ukraine intention to break this impasse here to allow these troops to escape, or is it to try to break it off to allow more reinforcements in? And now it would seem to be an obvious answer that it's to get these guys out. That's the only thing that makes any actual military sense. But unfortunately, as I've mentioned to you in all these, especially in the Kherson area over the Dnipro in the past, or in you can even go back to Avdiivka, and definitely into Kursk in the north. They continued, the Ukraine side continued to put reinforcements in those areas, in both Kherson and the Kursk area in particular, well after it was too late, after it was clear that there was no longer any military utility to have. They continued to put more and more reinforcements into an area to just delay the inevitable, sacrificing everybody who was in there and the reinforcements too. So I don't know yet, and we are just left to wonder what the intent is here, why they're fighting so hard in this one area where they do have some offensive movement, and it's making it very difficult on the Russians here. Is that to get more troops in? And I'm not sure that they have many more troops. I don't know where they would pull them from, or is it to get them out? I, for the lives of these men here and their families, I hope that the idea is to get them out. That's the only thing that even makes even cynical sense, because if you can get these guys out, then you can have more defensive positions up here to make any much, you know, especially in this town right here, to make every additional forward movement by the Russian side much more painful and more difficult. That would make some sense. But to try and put more people in here would just be to literally send your men to suicide, because they would have no chance. They don't have any chance. And it's unclear. Well, I mean, it's partially unclear. Militarily, it doesn't make any sense that they should have left them. But as I said, the Ukraine side has done many things that don't make a lot of sense. So let's continue to move up the line here. So that was the Mirnograd and the Pokrovsk area. Now we come up here to Seversk area. The Russians continue to put a lot of pressure on Seversk, and now that they have come close up to the outskirts of the city of Seversk, of course, it's under a lot of fire control already from all of these areas here, where Russia is very close to the outskirts of them. There's a lot of movement into the gray zone up here, where they're putting pressure on the one logistics lifeline that goes into the defenders in Seversk. They've obviously already got it under fire control from the south as well. And this road here can't go anywhere, so this is almost already unusable. This is the one lifeline into the city, and Russia's trying to put pressure on that from multiple directions as well. This continues to shrink, and it will continue to do so even after that. Next, we want to go up into the Kupiansk area, and there has been some major changes in the last 12 hours since even yesterday when I talked to you about it. And you see that the gray zone has expanded. The Russian full control zone has expanded. There was a pretty significant move into a rail junction on the what was in the Russian Ukraine control side of Kupiansk overnight, and then additional movement forward by the Russians. So all of this was turned into fully Russian control. To go along with the gray areas here, you see that the area of the Ukraine side is increasingly squeezed out here. And some of the interesting thoughts here, and I'm going to, not thoughts, but evidence here, which I'll explain in more detail here shortly, is that much of the Russians were seen moving in some of these areas just out in the open, not even worried about drones, which is a big change. And we're going to explain to you why in just a second. But this is part of the consequence of what happens and why there isn't more drone activity on the Ukraine side that allowed this big push. I mean, just look at that. A significant portion of Kupiansk is now under the Russian control, and it's not much longer before the rest of that city falls. And then they're going to be facing shortly the same dilemma here, because you see that the Russians have moved up to this area here, and the maw of this encirclement is also ready to close. And if Russians have moved this much in 12 hours, we'll see if they have the ability to keep that pressure on, or if they move any up from the southern portion of this pincer movement to completely cut it off. And will all of these Ukrainian troops also fall into complete encirclement? So everywhere you look, that the Ukraine side is getting pushed back. Of course, in the Kursk area, you see the Russians continue to take area here. Now, it wasn't just a month or two ago that none of this stuff was even here. They were making a little bit of progress, but now Russia has put more effort here. There's even a small penetration up in the northern part here, and then around Volchansk. The Russians have now, for the most part, taken that village and are moving even further south than that. And that's why you see these gray zones on the rest, because it looks like Russia is trying to expand their view here. So all along the front, from Kharkiv region all the way down to Kupiansk, all the way down through Seversk area, and then to all the way back down here into the Zaporizhia area, you see the Ukraine side is getting pushed back everywhere. There is no place that you want to say, yes, this is a victory here, this is going well, and this is something I want to hang my hat on, like Zelensky tried to do in Kharkiv City. In Kherson City. And let me show you some of the reasons why, because as I said at the outset of this, even the nature of this fight has gone through an evolutionary change, and the Russian side has gotten the advantage here. Now, I've been telling you for all of this year, really, that the things in this war have gone through this cycle of one side makes an innovation, it has an advantage over the other side, they figure it out, and then they neutralize it, and then they come up with something new, and then they get up on the other side, and then the Ukraine side in this case also figures a way to counter it, and then they get back, et cetera. So you keep getting this counteraction, et cetera. But all the time in a war of attrition, it always comes back to the manpower. Everything comes back to the manpower, and the side that doesn't have the manpower is eventually going to lose, because you can only go through so many of these iterations before now then your side isn't able to pick back up. And that's where we are right now. What remains to be seen is this just a delayed action? Will the Ukraine side figure a way to once again counter the counter on the Russian side, or is this one of it that's going to lead to the death knell? So far, it's looking pretty bad for the Ukraine side, because they don't have the manpower and they don't have the industrial base to be able to offset Russia's tactical and technical advancements, or their manpower issue, or their defense industrial base. They just have more of it. And at this point, they have used the more unique capacity to bring this to about. Now, I'm going to show you, I mentioned a minute ago that there was some footage that came from Pokrovsk, where the Russians were advancing in pretty large numbers out in the open in some fog. This is that video right here. And this is from, I think, just one day ago. And you see a lot of things here. And this looks like a bunch of, some people look at this as just a ragtag. You have a bunch of Russian soldiers, some on foot, some on motorcycles, some in vehicles. You don't see any tanks or anything like that. And you may think, wow, this is just evidence of Russia, just how ragtag they are. So they're really not a modern force. Folks, this is what the face of modern war looks like. If you don't have some kind of version like this, you're not going to succeed in modern warfare. You think that, well, the NATO would come and they'd be in our M1 tanks or our Challenger tanks, Leopards. We'd have the Stryker vehicles. We'd have all the armored vehicles and everything, and we'd be able to do a lot better than this. The Russians have that stuff, not had, have those kinds of vehicles. They have their versions of it. They have all different categories of tanks, armored personnel carriers, et cetera. They have them. But there's a reason why they're not using them, not because they don't have them. They have the, for example, there's been some even T-55s or older T-72s, T-64s. There's also T-80s, T-90s. They have a whole mix of different tanks, but they're not used in big armored assaults because they are vulnerable to the drone strikes. They are using those, though, because they use them basically in indirect fire or even fire support from a distance when they come up to places where the Ukraine side is dug in or where they have fortifications built, et cetera. They do it from a distance. They rarely use them. And in fact, it's been years since I've seen any video footage anyway of any kind of armored tank-on-tank kind of battles. Now it's just using armored vehicles as an armored taxi to try to get to places. But even that's going down. The reason why, let's look at some of these. That vehicle right there you just saw, that looks like some kind of vehicle they took the doors off of, that kind of van-looking thing there. They also had the doors. This one here, yeah, thanks for freezing that there, Gary. Appreciate it. You see guys just kind of hanging out in the doors, right? Some guys sitting there on top of it. He's probably the drone spotter, making sure that nobody comes in, that the drone doesn't come and get them. But there's a reason why those doors are open, because there are so many of these drone shots that we've shown you from both sides of the line often show regular civilian type vehicles being hit with drones left and right. So now then they have these that they can quickly get out of. So with the guy, the spotter on the top of the vehicle, or anybody in any of the car spots a vehicle, there's probably some kind of a code word given, and just everybody immediately gets out of the vehicle, finds the closest cover they can get, so that if the vehicle gets hit with the drone, they've lost the vehicle, but they themselves are still able to fight and live another day. The motorcycles, that would seem to be also a bad one. You're like going, hang on just a second. Motorcycles, there's no armor for that. I mean, just a regular machine gun can take you out. Certainly a drone. Well, here's the thing about that. There's not many direct fire engagements either, even with machine guns. That happens sometimes when you get into trench warfare, for example. But what the Russians use these for, and I think the Ukraine side to a limited degree, is they move these things to move quickly, because it's hard to get the drones' maneuverability to hit a fast-moving vehicle like that, that can just drive in all kinds of wild and crazy ways and gyrate and move left and right, et cetera, and be very unpredictable in how they're moving when they're going forward. So that gives them a chance to evade from these drones. Whereas if you're in a Stryker vehicle, if you're in an M1 tank, great vehicles as far as they go, but they can't maneuver quickly. They're going to drive in a straight line. I've driven some of these, and I've been an armored unit, so I can tell you from firsthand experience, these things are not very maneuverable. They were never designed to be. They were designed to be able to absorb a lot of direct fire weapons, et cetera, and to keep the guys safe inside from what was conventional war all through World War II, Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom, et cetera, up until about 2020, when the Armenian-Azerbaijan war started to change the face of armored mechanized warfare, and this war here has taken it to yet a new level. So there's still a place for that for armored vehicles, but you see here there's a lot of other vehicles that now seem to be technologically regression, but it's how you use the technology you have and if you have the manpower. Now, specifically in the drones, I want to play this video here from the Duran just here recently, where a guy named Scott from Calibrated talked about some of the advancements in the drone warfare and how Russia is currently on top.
The real issue is when the manpower issues start to affect the drone operators. Drone operators are what keep the lines together, and a lot of those drone operators have been pulled from other sections of the front to Pokrovsk to try to de-block this encirclement and have been destroyed, I guess you would say, for lack of a better term, by certain groups like Rubicon, which is a Russian UAV unit who actively hunts Ukrainian UAV units. And what we're now seeing is massive gaps across the front line. I had just talked about Zaporozhye. Where in eastern Zaporozhye, the Russians are advancing incredibly fast, and they're out walking in the open, something we haven't seen for like the last 3 years of this war because of the constant threat of FPV drones.
See, and that's what I mentioned earlier. There have been places along the front where you see Russians, sometimes from their own drone videos that you see, where they're just moving without any care or concern. Obviously, those in that previous video that we showed you, they were moving completely without concern because of the fog. And when you have heavy fog like that, that's your one shot to really move, because the drones can't see through fog very well. There are some that have the thermal imagery, whatever, but even that has limited. I've seen how the fog could limit even thermal viewfinders that are very good. But for the most part, it's not. Of course, you can still hear. But if those drones can't see through the fog very well, then that's your time to move. And that's why the Russians were moving in large numbers. Otherwise, you see nearly everything you see is that Russians move, and the Ukraine side too, when they do their counterattacks, in groups of two or three. That's all, that you hardly ever see anything more than that. It's very rare, because you can get one drone, maybe it takes out two or three guys, and even they'll be dispersed. But if you have, you know, a platoon of guys or 15 or 20 guys, you know, you, one drone can take out quite a few. So nobody moves in those in the open anymore, unless you've had your drone capability to whittle away the other side. So there are entire units, probably on both sides too, but the Russians appear to be having more effectiveness of it. Units specifically designed to only take out the other side's drone units from their drone operator. So it's drone operator against drone operator. So aside from whatever is happening on the ground with the direct firefight or trying to dislodge somebody from a building or take them out of a defended position, you've also got specific and primarily trained units to take out the other side's drone operators. If you succeed with that, then the guys who are on the ground can move in the open. And if you strip away the drone coverage from a certain area by taking out their capacity to even operate the drones, then you have the opportunity to make big, bold movements forward. Then you can get back into the possibility of even having big maneuver warfare again, especially if you can do that in a large enough area. Now, so far, the Russians haven't done that, but I would imagine that they're probably proving the concept here and to make sure that they can do something on a large scale. Because if they ever have any designs, and this goes for any NATO forces in the future too, even in their concept of war, if you ever have any hope of conducting classical maneuver warfare, is the type that I fought in Desert Storm, where drones didn't even exist in any numbers, you're going to have to get to a place where you can strip away the opponent's ability to launch their own drones, whether that's reconnaissance drones, the bomber drones where they drop on top, or the other kinds of, you know, the first person view drones, etc. You're going to have to knock those out, and that means you're going to have to get the operators out. That's the primary thing. Now, the Ukraine side, because they have a manpower crunch, they have a limited number of trained drones. And when you know that it's no longer just the guys at the front, earlier in this war, the drone operators from both sides were pretty safe because they could move pretty far back and, you know, sometimes 5 to 10 to 15 kilometers away from the front, and they could get these drones to come in along the front. Well, now then both sides realize, yeah, we have longer range drones now, more battery power, they can stay aloft a lot longer, and the technology is available, especially with the fiber optic drones, which you don't have to worry about being electronic warfare, where they're now going hunting the drone operators. And there's ways to do that, and they've got ways to identify them. But the Russians specifically have an advancing, highly coordinated and effective anti-drone system, not just platforms, but a system. They are layering counter-drone technology, electronic warfare drones, small radars, and drones that go after drones themselves. They have some that are using AI technology to where, and then in fact, that video that Gary was showing you a minute ago on the fog, you may have seen that one shot where there's a drone just sitting on the street. It was just like on the road, sitting there by itself, a pretty good sized one. What the Russians have been doing, and both sides to a certain extent, let's see, he's going to show it in just a second here. I think it's off to the left. What they had done is they'll have these drones and they'll just sit there. I think that's just to the left of that soldier right there. They'll just sit there and wait, oftentimes in a road like this where it can be seen, but usually it's kind of in the underbrush off to the side of it. That's it right there. Thanks, Gary. What they'll do is the drone will just sit there, and it has sensors on it where it can hear any of the approach of any vehicles. It can sometimes, depending on the kind of sensors they have, it can tell if there's any movement on the road, et cetera. And then at the command, whoever's operating the thing can then launch it. So the other side doesn't even know there's a drone there. It can launch it up and then suddenly strike within literally seconds, and nobody has a chance to do anything. That's becoming more common as well. So you have the Russian side to using these small radars, which can then also physically detect the incoming, and then they can launch their own anti-drone drones that go after the platforms and get them in the air. So if the Russian side is able to have enough qualified drone operators, anti-drone units, and then anti-drone drones to be able to strip away. You see one after the other. One takes out the operators. One takes out the drones when they're coming in. And the electronic warfare, of course, has for a while been taking them down if they're not fiber optic drones, which the Ukraine side has as well. But you see all this stuff layered together, and the Russians have been prioritizing this. And then you see that the Russians don't use a lot of armored vehicles, which is target-rich environment for any drone. You see they're using older technology, but in newer ways, in ways that keep their troops alive and allows them to move forward. And I just showed you that map, folks. They're doing this all along the entire front line. So everywhere we look, the Ukraine military is getting smaller. Their morale is going down. Even in that earlier video we showed you from the very beginning of that, where they're shouting, Slava Ukraine or whatever it was, the victory and above all, you didn't see any conviction on their face. And that's the guys that are on the camera, in a relative safe spot. Gary showed you this video just a few days ago of some of the prisoners, of the Ukraine prisoners that were captured in the Pokrovsk area. There's been a couple we've shown here recently, actually, and they just have this just shell-shocked look on their face. That's one of them. That's the one that Gary showed. I mean, I made mention when we showed this the first time that when I was part of the group that took and interrogated some prisoners in Desert Storm, that it was identical. I mean, who cares about what their nationalities was? The shell shock look on the especially that first guy there, the second one here. Just a really hollow look from somebody who just, you can imagine just how awful they are. And they talked about how the morale was really low. There was another video that we showed maybe a week or so ago from a group that said that they had been sent in to reinforce Pokrovsk. And he said a whole battalion, there was 500 guys, and 300 had already been killed. A bunch of others had been wounded, and there was just a handful left in a building that were even alive. That's regular. That's routine. And when you're losing troops like that, when your morale is falling through the bottom like that because you can't get quality recruits, and when you lose people in that large numbers, and then the other side figures out how to go after your drone operators, and they figure out how to knock down more of your drones on top of all of these theater-level strategic drones that they have with these Garand 2s, now Garand 3s, with these Kinzhal missiles, other hypersonic missiles, these long-range multiple-launch rocket systems, literally just devastating all over your country. The end is coming. And I've heard it from some folks who recently have said that they have sources that say that so far the Ukraine leadership, military and political, nobody's leaving anywhere. So that's why I say I have serious doubts about whether Ukraine is trying to fight in the Rodinska area north of Pokrovsk in order to have a passage to extricate their troops out of Mirnograd, or if they're just trying to fight in there to even put more people in the pocket to die. I don't know, because based on their behavior, it could be both. That's certainly going to lower your motivation even further if you realize that you're being sent into join some other guys who are already marked for death or capture. That's not going to really raise your morale much. But it looks like that the Ukraine leadership across the board has said, we're just going to keep fighting and dying in place. Whether that's in Kharkiv up in the north, in Kupiansk, in Seversk, or down in Pokrovsk, or in Zaporizhia area, opposite Kherson, there's some fighting going on down there. I didn't mention earlier, everywhere you look, the Russians are advancing. Nowhere is there any possibility that on even a portion of the front, is there an option for Ukraine to start moving the front backwards. It just simply doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, then where is the morality that says we're going to keep fighting? We're going to keep going. You can't reverse here. Sanctions, they don't have any impact. The more weapons that you're claiming you're going to get from the Europeans, from being sold from the United States, air defense missiles, all those do is slow down the air attack some. Not that much, as you see, because no matter how many air defense weapons you have, the Russians will be able to saturate it with more platforms in the air. And whatever you take out, there's always more on the Russian side that's going to go in. And those images Gary's showing you right there will just become a regular daily occurrence. And now then, as we're really getting into the cold weather system and as season, it's just going to be really, really hard for the people to even live. That's, of course, if the people are suffering, you can only imagine how much the troops on the front line are suffering as well. And at some point, just the mathematics and just human nature is going to kick in. And I think that in the new year, as we get through the maybe even into before we even get out of the winter of 2026, I think the chances of you seeing large sections of the front collapsing are going to increase. Now, I suggested there was a chance they could have collapsed last summer. They didn't. They added another whole year. But the fundamentals that led me to believe that was possible then were accurate, because it was. But the courage and the tenacity of the Ukraine side and their just absolute unwillingness to acknowledge reality, they kept fighting anyway. So they didn't fall. Don't gain any confidence from that. It's not like, well, they held on then so they can hold on forever, because in the year, since they didn't collapse in the summer of 2024, there have probably been hundreds of thousands of men who died. Not just wounded, that's probably hundreds of thousands more. But there's hundreds of thousands died, and there just aren't more. We showed you a graphic here just in the last couple of months. 100,000 men age 18 to 22 have fled the country. The desertions are just off the charts. The casualties themselves are off the charts. And there just aren't people enough that are still in the men that are still in the country. There just aren't enough of them to come in. And the reason why you keep seeing all of those videos of people being beaten on the streets, thrown into vans and put into transportation to get to the front is because they know it's nearly a death sentence. And it is. That's how it's working out. And you can't grab people off the streets like that and ever think that you're going to turn the tide when you see the Russian sides are moving forward and their morale is through the roof. And we've seen that, and it makes sense. It's understandable. That's the reason they're still able. Yeah, they pay a lot of money for bonuses, but don't gain any confidence from that either, because the guys do come in. The money is enough because they like, I want to be part of this. I want to be a part of something that's winning. And they don't think it's a death sentence, or they wouldn't volunteer. So they're still volunteering for this at numbers that allow them to not have to do any forced mobilizations. Everything is moving in the direction where this cannot succeed. Yeah, that's routine right there. It's incredible. And that tells you everything you need to know. Folks, there are no fundamentals other than just these wishful thinking by Volodymyr Zelensky, I showed you at the beginning, or Keir Starmer, or Merz, or Duda out of Poland, literally everyone, Macron, Mark Rutte from NATO, Ursula von der Leyen, Kaya Kallas. So all these big speeches these folks always made and all these thunderous applause they get when they speak in different parliaments, none of those folks have to face all this stuff I've just showed you here, all these videos that Gary has shown you here today. That is the reality. That's what's going on the front. And that is where this war will be lost. Not in the thunderous applause and the statements that are detached from reality that they're making on a daily basis. And there will have to be a reckoning for this, because it's just inevitable that it's going to come. There are no fundamentals that exist that this can be even stopped, much less even reversed. That's not even possible. And we'll just have to track this and we'll keep you appraised as it goes on. But it's just something that is going to be egregious that historians will look back on and populations will say, how could you guys have been so careless, so gutless, and so callous to the human suffering of your side? And I guess the answer is going to be ignorance. It's going to be greed. It's going to be we just don't value human life. Whatever words come out of our mouth, I don't know, some combination of all that. But whatever, they're going to have to figure this out. And all those people by name I just mentioned, I'm telling you right now, history will not be kind to any of them. And they will be shamed and humiliated. Can't come soon enough. And anything that keeps this war going on is a shame in and of itself. And I would love to see that end, because I genuinely care a lot about the men that are suffering in Ukraine, about the civilian population that's suffering in Ukraine, only because we are keeping the war going. Yes, I got it. It's the Russians that are firing the bombs and the missiles and the drones, and they're the ones that are pulling the triggers, and that's killing a lot of Ukrainians. That's a fact. This is a war, and that's just how it works in the war. Once you started it, you've got to be able to finish it, either through negotiations or from winning it. And if the side is going to be able to win it, that's the ugliness of war. That's why I detest and despise war, because once it gets started, there's no going back, and unless you're going to do the rational, logical thing and see that you can't win it and end it so that no more people die. Otherwise, you're going to have what the Russians are doing. You can hate the Russians all day long for what they're doing, and I get it, but they have the power. As is throughout the history of mankind, anyone who's got the power pushes it on until they get what they want and they succeed on the battlefield. And we can dislike that, we can hate it, but as long as we keep ignoring it, more men are going to die. That's where we are, folks. We're going to continue to bring this stuff as it breaks and happens. Also, man, do we have a great one for you this afternoon. We've been getting people, been asking for a long time to find the MIT professor Ted Postol to come and tell us what in the world is going on with this Russian doomsday weapon, whether it's with the Poseidon, the one that goes underwater, the nuclear propulsion system there, or the Burevestnik, the new cruise missile that has a nuclear warhead capability and a nuclear propulsion system. We kind of finally got Ted Postol back with us today. 2 o'clock, he's going to give us their bottom line, his bottom line about what's going on. And then at 3:30, you may have seen that there was a vote in the Senate last night to end the government shutdown in the United States. We're going to tell you what that means and what still has to happen in the House of Representatives. It could come as early as tomorrow, but there are some caveats with that too. Join us for that at 3:30 today, and we will see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.